From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, syndicated columnist Molly Ivins. She covered George W. Bush when he was governor of Texas. In the new book, Bushwhacked, she critiques the Bush presidency. Also, we talk with the poet Dana Gioia, who is now the chair of the National Endowment for the Arts. He's also the author of the controversial 1991 essay, Can Poetry Matter? That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. California voters have been flocking to the polls today to decide whether to remove Governor Gray Davis from office. Election officials say high voter turnout and fewer polling locations are causing some problems. NPR's Mondalit Del Barco reports from Los Angeles.
The lines to vote have been long all day at a temporary polling place in a garage of one house in the Pico Rivera neighborhood in East L.A. Poll workers say hundreds of people have been turning out to vote on old punch card ballots that have been used in L.A. for 35 years. They're urging people to check their ballots for hanging, dimpled, and pregnant chads to avoid problems that plagued the Florida presidential election in 2000. Because of the short time it took to get this election together, there are 3,000 fewer polling places in L.A. Some voters are confused about where they need to vote, and the lines have been longer than usual. One L.A. city councilman is complaining about the polling conditions, saying they are overcrowded and understaffed. Polls will stay open until 8 p.m. local time. Mondalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
A federal appeals court in Denver says the Federal Trade Commission can enforce the national Do Not Call registry while an appeals court considers its constitutionality. NPR's Paul Brown reports.
The decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals puts on hold a federal judge's order that said the Do Not Call registry violates the free speech rights of the telemarketing industry. U.S. District Judge Edward Nottingham had stopped the Federal Trade Commission from implementing the registry. He said it was unfair in blocking telemarketing calls from businesses but not charities and nonprofits. The Court of Appeals said that until the legal status of Do Not Call is determined, the Federal Trade Commission can put the registry into effect and can fine telemarketers up to $11,000 each time they call one of the 51 million numbers now on the list. Last week, the same court said the Federal Communications Commission could enforce the list. Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush said today that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was justified in ordering an airstrike deep into Syrian territory on Sunday.
The Prime Minister must defend his country. It's essential. This is a country which recently was attacked by a suicider that killed innocent children and women.
Israel said its warplanes attacked a terrorist training camp in Syria. The attack came after Islamic Jihad, a Palestinian militant group, claimed responsibility for a suicide bombing that killed 19 people at a restaurant in Haifa, Israel, on Saturday. Islamic Jihad denied having any training camps in Syria. In stocks today, the Dow gained 59 points to close at 96.54. The Nasdaq gained 14 to close at 1907. This is NPR News. Colorado's attorney general is asking a judge not to destroy records of interviews with the parents of two boys responsible for the 1999 Columbine school shooting. NPR's Jeff Brady reports from Denver.
Federal Judge Patricia Cohen ordered transcripts of the interviews destroyed after a lawsuit against the boys' parents was settled in August. Colorado Attorney General Ken Salazar says there's an overriding public interest in preserving the records. He says they may reveal possible warning signs or causes that could help explain why Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold launched their attack on students at Columbine High School. Salazar co-founded a group called the Columbine Open Records Task Force, which seeks to have information about the shootings made public. Victims' families also have asked the judge not to destroy the records. They know what's in the depositions, but have been ordered not to publicly discuss the contents. The families say they wouldn't have settled the case had they known the documents would be kept secret and destroyed. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
The Coca-Cola company has agreed to pay $540,000 to a former finance manager who accused the soft drink maker of faking a marketing test of a new product. The company said it settled a wrongful termination suit brought by Matthew Whitley. Coke initially maintained that Whitley was laid off because of downsizing and not because of his whistleblowing. The company has since admitted that its employees in Virginia faked a marketing test that convinced Burger King to invest millions of dollars in frozen Coke. Whitley's accusations resulted in an ongoing federal investigation of Coke and an inquiry by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Molly Ivins, is a syndicated political columnist based in Austin, Texas, who is known for her outspoken views and biting wit. She wrote about George W. Bush when he was the governor of Texas, and she's continued to write about him as president. She's a critic of the president, and she explains why in her new book, Bushwhacked: Life in George W. Bush's America. It's co-authored with Lou Dubose, with whom she also wrote the 1999 bestseller Shrub about Bush's years as governor. Her book, Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She?, was also a bestseller. Ivins is the former co-editor of the Texas Observer. Now, you're in an interesting position living in Texas and having followed George W. Bush's career as governor of that state. You can see some of the things that he accomplished in Texas that he's patterning programs on as president of the United States. Can we talk about a couple of those?
Sure.
One of the biggest domestic stories in the Bush administration is his tax cuts. And you watched him preside over tax cuts in Texas. What was the extent of the tax cuts there?
They were very large by our standards. When Bush came into office in 94, he inherited a very tidy surplus from his predecessor and promptly gave tax cuts to property owners. And then having done that once, he went back and did it again. And as a consequence, the state was left with no money in its rainy day fund, that is to say, nothing in a savings account. And when we got hit with the economic downturn along with everybody else, there was the state stony broke with nothing in reserve, and we wound up having to whack $10 billion out of what nobody has ever considered a generous budget.
What have the repercussions been? Have there been cuts in services? I mean, what?
Oh, absolutely. And unfortunately, it was done in such a almost heartbreaking way. Texas is not generous with social services. We're lucky to be a step ahead of Mississippi. We wound up cutting from children, old people, and sick people.
What kind of programs?
Children's health insurance program, home care for the elderly. We just hit all the social services. But God bless Texas. At least we're still maintaining a healthy business climate.
When you're looking at the proposals to further cut tax cuts in America, what do you think about regarding Texas?
Well, again, there's an old country western song called Lubbock on Everything. And sometimes I think that what we are now watching is Texas on Everything. It's as though W had gone to Washington to spread the great gospel of the Lone Star State all over the entire country. And it's always been my observation. I think that Texas is the national laboratory for bad government. Every nutty idea that's ever been thought of has been tried here and generally proved to be absolutely worthless. And to watch Bush take these same ideas to Washington and try to replicate them nationwide makes me wonder why the other 49 states haven't just seceded.
You write that one casualty of the budget crash is the state's public schools, and you're talking about Texas here.
Right.
And education has been very important to President Bush as president of the United States, is he trying to replicate anything nationally that he tried in Texas as governor?
Oh, absolutely. One of his great claims to fame was the Texas education miracle. And he particularly emphasized standards, testing. What's interesting is, of course, that indeed Texas public schools have improved since the 1970s. And many governors have struggled with this over the years, and particularly the problem of equitable school financing, because the state was hauled into court and this long-running lawsuit was finally ruled against the state and said that we were just doing a terrible job of balancing the way we pay for schools. So that was a huge struggle in the legislature, culminating in something called the Robin Hood Plan, in theory taking from the rich and giving to the poor. And I must say there was some improvement. And when I wrote about Bush in 2000 during the presidential campaign, I said, look, you know, this guy's record is mostly either not impressive or depressing, but there is this one bright spot. He really is interested in education. He really understands the issue, and he put a lot of time and energy into it. I didn't know at the time, and in the new book, we report that what had appeared to be significant advances in education in Texas, improving scores, and just a general upward trend, turned out to have been, heartbreakingly enough, slightly fraudulent. What happened was we were getting higher scores by increasing the dropout rate, which, depending on which study you believe, may be somewhere short of 40%, which is really pretty ugly. And what you're seeing, for example, students have to be tested in 4th and 9th grade, or 10th grade. And so at the high school level, you have kids who remain in high school for 3 years as technical 9th graders. They're never allowed to advance because they would lower the school's cumulative score. And this kind of sort of cheating, for lack of a better word, let's just call it cheating, was, of course, provoked by these requirements laid on public schools by the state without sufficient funds to back them up. In other words, they were told, perform, do better, but not given any wherewithal to do better. And there you are again. It's exactly the same thing at the national level. I mean, Bush's first big play was the education bill called No Child Left Behind. And Senator Edward Kennedy worked with the administration on that. And they came up with, you know, a plan to, again, standards, testing. Let's see the results. Let's find out how these kids are doing. And then Bush refused to fully fund what he had committed to with Kennedy in the course of negotiating for that bill. There's no use demanding higher standards of schools unless you give them something to work with.
Now, you're implying that schools are just as happy that the kids who score low drop out because then the school looks better on the standardized test scores.
I am more than implying that. I'm stating that.
And why would the schools want the kids out to make the test scores look better?
Well, if you're the principal of a school that doesn't meet the standards of the state, you know, a sufficient number of kids pass the test so that you get approval, then, among other things, you're fired, you're gone.
So how does this system that you're describing in Texas compare to what's being put in place in the U.S.?
Well, the No Child Left Behind Act, you will find if you talk to educators around the country, is being found to have serious drawbacks, and a whole lot of hell is being raised about it on a lot of different levels. But I think, it comes back to the fact that you demand more of the schools without giving them any more resources.
If you're just joining us, my guest is syndicated columnist Molly Ivins. She is a native of Texas, continues to live there. Her new book is called Bushwhacked: Life in George W. Bush's America. You write about the president's religion, and you say, while you acknowledge that, you know, religion is usually off limits for the press to write about, you think it's important to bring it up in the case of President Bush. Why?
Well, I think that George W. Bush, unlike his father, his dad, George Bush, was clearly a sort of upper-class Eastern WASP. Is really consciously, culturally identified as a Texan. And you see in his character sort of three common strands of Texas culture. One is religiosity, anti-intellectualism, and machismo. And all three of them are very appealing to broad groups of voters. And I think in Bush's case, at least with the first two, absolutely genuine. I think the religiosity is genuine, and I think it needs to be looked at, as I say, mostly religion, pretty much, you know, you leave it out of pace. But to the extent that his religious beliefs influence policy, which they do at several intersections, then I think it's legitimate to take a look at it.
Now, in Bushwhacked, you describe the Bush administration as driven by ideology. What do you see as the ideology that drives it?
The ideology of this administration. There's an extent to which I did not think Bush as governor, while very conservative, but you understand conservative in a sort of Texas, I don't know how to explain this, there's a certain kind of provincialism. I believe that provincialism is a universal characteristic, but I must admit, Texas is even more universal in that regard than most. When you know, there's a kind of Midland Petroleum Club mentality that Bush has had all along. I mean, he literally, the first time he ever ran for public office, he ran for Congress in 1978 on the grounds that Jimmy Carter was leading us toward European-style socialism. I mean, just Jimmy Carter, the very Baptist Jimmy Carter. But Bush himself, as a political operator, didn't seem to me, as governor, terribly ideologically motivated. He was on some issues, death penalty, some others you couldn't move him on. But basically, he was, you know, flexible enough to play the game with the powers that then were in the legislature. And I think Bush has always chosen, you know, these older male mentors, and his pick on his way to Washington was Dick Cheney, who is really quite ideological. If you go back, political reporters are great believers in look at the record. If you check Cheney's political record as a voting member of Congress, you'll find it's really quite extraordinary. He was often one of only one, two, or a handful of votes opposed to what would normally be considered, you know, the legislative equivalent of voting in favor of a resolution commending motherhood. And I think that part of what has happened is that Washington is such a polarized place, and there genuinely is the people who call themselves movement conservatives, who really genuinely subscribe to the ideology that government is bad, the marketplace will solve all problems, we're much better off, you know, with unfettered capitalism, no government, just let the marketplace solve everything. And that, I think that's almost like a religious belief rather than a political belief. It seems to be an article of faith with many of these people. Undeterred by reality, experience, the record, or anything else. And so it seems to me that Bush has actually become more ideological since he's gone to Washington, particularly to the extent that he, and this is a really elementary political mistake. I can't believe Karl Rove, who's a very smart guy, is really letting this happen. It seems to me the mistake is that they're only listening to one another, that there is a sort of loop of insiders, Rumsfeld and Cheney and all that circle of people. They're just talking to each other, and they're not hearing from anyone outside the circle, which is always a fatal mistake.
My guest is syndicated columnist Molly Ivins, co-author of the new book Bushwhacked. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is syndicated columnist Molly Ivins. In your book, Bushwhacked, you're critical of the Washington Press Corps. What's your problem with the Washington Press Corps?
Oh, man. Let me count the ways. One thing is I do find it conformist and pompous and self-important to a level that I find nearly unbearable. One of the things that annoys me about Washington, I should point this out, is not just that it's a city where everybody says exactly what everybody else says. I mean, truly, they are like blackbirds. But when I go to Washington, instead of coming in and saying, well, y'all, I am fresh in from the prairies of Texas, and I'm here to tell you that you're full of whatever, I'm not there for more than 10 minutes before I find myself saying exactly what everybody else says. That really drives me crazy, and it's the reason I avoid the town. But I do think that the press has been let itself be led around by the nose for quite a long time. I think during the Clinton era, we were goaded by political enemies of Clinton into devoting far too much time and attention to utterly unimportant and inane episodes like Filegate and Travelgate and Whitewater, which Lord knows have been investigated until the end of time and still no evidence of wrongdoing. And that constant sort of, you know, big scandal stuff. And then, oddly enough, when Bush came in, and I certainly had had enough scandal mongering during the Clinton administration, and I had absolutely no desire to see the same thing done to George W. when he took over. And I think that Bush got a fair honeymoon from the press corps. And then, of course, both because of September 11th, and, you know, we always rally behind the president in a national crisis, and we always rally behind the president in wars, and a war in Afghanistan, a war in Iraq. So there was just, you know, a long period of rallying there. And I think it is only now that many people are standing back and looking at the result of Bush's policies, and particularly, and what our book is about, the effect of those policies on people's lives. And what's astonishing about what we found when we went out and reported this, I mean, it was really astonishing to me, because I'm a political reporter. You would think that I would think it was the most important thing in the whole world. That government. If you had told us, I think, when we started this book, that a change in government policy, and we're talking about low-level stuff, where it never made the headlines, it never made the television news, this is all just boring, regular, you know, little change in regulation, a little executive order, a little funding cut, nothing very dramatic. So basically we're talking about the regulatory equivalent of changing subsection B in Article 2 of the Interstate Dilly-Dally Compact. And if you had told us when we started that people would actually die because of some of these decisions, I mean, dramatically said, it's a matter of life and death, we would have said, oh, please stop being so overdramatic, get a grip. And dang if we didn't find exactly that. Mm-hmm. People dying as a direct result of minor regulatory changes.
What's an example of one?
We have two in the book. One was the Clinton administration had planned to introduce something called microbial testing as a way of doing meat and poultry inspection. And this was to get away from the old sort of, you know, improve on the old scratch and sniff method. In other words, federal meat inspectors are in most meat packing and poultry processing plants, and their job is to go around, and if they see anything that looks and smells really bad, they're supposed to stop the line. And this system was clearly not entirely perfect. As you know, we have outbreaks of disease from time to time. And so they were going to put in this microbial testing thing, a new more kind of high-tech way of making sure that meat and poultry are safe. Well, the reality is that most meat and poultry processors are based in the red states, so-called red states, and they're very large donors to the Republican Party. And so when Bush came in, they simply put the kibosh on the proposed Clinton plan and went back to the old system. And so we traced an outbreak of listeriosis to one of the people who died as a result of it. In Philadelphia, we found it was very... Oh, Philadelphia, your hometown. Very cold winter last year, as you know. And one of the things that Bush had specifically promised to protect was a government program called LIHEAP, that stands for Low Income Heating Assistance Program. And during a presidential debate with Gore in Boston, Bush specifically said, and one of the things we'll do is fully fund LIHEAP, which is a program that helps people, particularly here in the Northeast, with their high heating bills. Well, of course, he then proceeded to slice $300 million out of this very same program. And they try hard in city utility world. They don't like to cut off poor people in, you know, who have way behind on their bills. In the middle of winter, they try and work out deals with them so you can pay during the summer months and all kinds of things. But the fact is that cut, as minor as it sounds in terms of the total federal budget, the $300 million cut in that one program, really did cause a fair number of people to lose heat. And three people died of hypothermia in their homes there last winter. That would be, to put it bluntly, they froze to death.
Syndicated columnist Molly Ivins. She co-authored the new book, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader, available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the University of Alabama School of Law, shaping the next generation, on the web at alabamalawschool.com. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of My Losing Season, a memoir of life, love, and basketball by Pat Conroy, author of The Prince of Tides. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with poet Dana Gioia, the chair of the National Endowment for the Arts, and we continue our conversation with Molly Ivins. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with syndicated columnist Molly Ivins. She lives in Texas and covered George W. Bush when he was governor. She co-authored a book about those years called Shrub. Now she's co-authored a book about the Bush presidency called Bushwhacked. I do want to ask you about something that everybody in Washington is writing and talking about, and that is whether a columnist and CNN commentator Bob Novak should be revealing the source or sources that leaked to him that the wife of Joe Wilson was a CIA operative.
Well, as a journalist, I would say one has an obligation to protect one's sources, and you would have to push me pretty far before I would change that. Now, I have, in my career, run across a situation where I would have revealed the name of an off-the-record source if I had been pushed, because it was so clear. It was a matter that involved justice and an innocent man. And I felt that my commitment to be off the record in the face of that kind of thing was not terribly important. Novak, of course, is going to have to make his own call on that. But if, indeed, six reporters were called by whoever in the administration with this information, I'm pretty confident that we can trust our professional colleagues to leak like sieves and that the information will be out in no time flat.
So you think the information will come out without Bob Novak having to
reporters
tell who his source
leak
was?
Worse than anybody.
Really?
Oh, always. Mm-hmm. Haven't you noticed? Terry.
You've said that there are two kinds of humor. One kind makes us chuckle about our foibles and our shared humanity, like what Garrison Keillor does. The other kind holds people up to public contempt and ridicule. And you said, that's what I do. What works about that form of humor for you?
Okay, well, I think that satire is, and it's not my opinion, but you can look at the whole range of history, going back to ancient Athens, ancient Rome. Satire is a weapon, and it can be quite a cruel weapon, too. I mean, it can really injure and harm, but mostly I think it does make people laugh. It's always been a weapon of the powerless against the powerful. And so if you aim it, as I do, at politicians. I mean, I do try to remember from time to time that many of them have wives and mothers who love them. But mostly I figure, oh, hell, nobody ever held a gun to their heads and forced them to run for public office. It's not my problem. I try to reserve contempt and ridicule not only for the deserving, but the deserving who have put themselves in the public eye. In other words, we try not to hit civilians. What has worried me a bit about some of what passes for humor in recent years is that I find that it is often satire aimed at the powerless. One hears it on Rush Limbaugh, and even more on the programs of Limbaugh's imitators, the little Limbaughlings who seem to exist in almost every radio market. When you aim satire at helpless people, it's not only cruel, it's profoundly vulgar.
Do you think you were ever good at nonpartisan straight reporting before you became a columnist?
Oh, sure. I've always spent years as a reporter on the street, and I'm even, not that I would claim much for that, reporters not necessarily a great and magnificent profession, barely even a trade, some would say. But I do think that there is something to be said for having spent several years of one's life doing things like going out and interviewing all five eyewitnesses to an automobile accident and then trying to write an accurate, coherent account of what happened. That will give you a considerable respect for the complexity of truth. And the difficulty, you can get facts straight and let the truth go hang itself, even more unforgivably, get facts wrong. And you learn as a reporter how to check, how to make sure, how to get it right. And what really bothers me is how many people are now political commentators who were never reporters. They have come straight off the front lines of partisan political warfare. They were campaign honchos or speech writers or aides to somebody or other. And none of them seem to have spent any time as reporters. And again, I'm not claiming much for our trade, but I do think that some respect for the difficulty of truth, for a just sort of not carelessly firing partisan opinion around as though all facts could be bent to a point of view.
And do you think that's what's happening now in a lot of TV and radio, that it's more about the spin than about trying to find the truth?
All the time. And those dreadful sort of gong shows where they go on it seems to be a sort of, you know, like the World Wrestling Federation or something in political drag. They go on and snipe at one another to absolutely no one's enlightenment or understanding or better comprehension of the situation. It's just annoying.
Your parents were Republicans. What were the life-changing episodes in your life that made you become a Democrat?
Oh, I think I'm a pretty classic case. You really can't talk to a Southern liberal of a certain age without the answer being race. How did you become a liberal in the South or wherever you came from? Race, race, race. I mean, that's just where I grew up in East Texas before the Civil Rights Movement, and had always thought that the way blacks were treated was wrong. I mean, it was perfectly clear to me that it was rotten and unfair and unnecessary and ugly. And not that I was, you know, when I was seven that I thought in those terms, but I did notice that my mother tried to teach me good manners, that we were breaking some of those rules when it came to black people. And so when the Civil Rights movement came along, I was part of it in a very minor way, nothing heroic. I mean, you know, it was East Texas. We had a tacky Civil Rights movement. But that experience showed me how much things can change in this country, how fast things can change in this country, what happens when people stand up and fight and scream and yell, how much difference they can make. And it showed me what an important role government can play in trying to get us a little further down the road toward liberty and justice for all.
Molly Ivins, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Syndicated columnist Molly Ivins is co-author of the new book, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. Coming up, poet Dana Gioia, the first poet to head the National Endowment for the Arts. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Dana Gioia, is the first poet to head the National Endowment for the Arts. He was chosen by President George W. Bush and assumed office early this year. Gioia's book of poems, Interrogations at Noon, published 2 years ago, included excerpts of the libretto he wrote for the opera Nosferatu. He's also the author of the controversial 1991 essay, Can Poetry Matter?, in which he argued that the cultural importance of poetry was declining, in part because poets were writing for other poets and academics. Before Gioia made a living through his writing, he worked as a vice president of General Foods, where he oversaw the marketing of Kool-Aid and Jell-O, including the Jell-O Jigglers campaign. As part of his work at the NEA, he's initiated a nationwide tour of Shakespeare's works performed by 6 theater companies. In the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that Fresh Air receives partial funding from the NEA. I asked Dana Gioia to sum up the arguments he made in his 1991 essay, Can Poetry Matter?, and to reflect on where poetry fits in American culture today.
My essay, Can Poetry Matter?, started with a cultural paradox, which was that never in the history of humanity had a nation, you know, spent, as it were, so much money to have people profess poetry, to create this official culture of poetry. And yet, never in the history of humanity had there seemed to be a nation in which poetry mattered less among the educated people. And so it seemed to me that there was some sort of cultural disconnect between the what I call the subculture of poetry and the general culture. And I talked about ways in which the power of poetry, the power of this primal human art, could be reconnected to general American society. The poetry world has changed rather dramatically. You now have across the United States civic-based poetry festivals. You have readings commonly in bookstores. You have poetry on the radio. These things have all been very effective ways of building the audience for poetry and taking the conversation that is culture and involving not merely the specialists in it, but the non-specialist.
Poets have to figure out how to make a living because they're probably not going to make it from the poems themselves. Only a few lucky poets are able to actually do that. So many poets teach, and I think that's one of the reasons why many poets teach. Your solution to that question was to work in the corporate world for about 15 years. You were a vice president at General Foods. You ended up being a product manager for Country Time Lemonade, and you worked for Kool-Aid. Did you think of yourself as a marketing expert who wrote poetry or as a poet who needed a day job, or were you able to think of yourself as both at the same time?
Well, I always tried to put in an honest day's work and all too frequently an honest evening's work, too. But I am probably the only human being who's ever gone to Stanford Business School to be a poet. I was at graduate school at Harvard, and I realized that I wanted to be a poet and that the university would not necessarily be the best place to do that, that I was being trained in some ways to write about literature and talk about literature in a way that not everyone could understand, and that, in fact, the very people that I came from, you know, I'm a working-class kid from L.A., were not really able to understand the way that I spoke about literature at the university. My parents are wonderful people, but they neglected to give me the private income I so richly deserved, and so I had to make a living somehow. And I decided that, you know, in the tradition of Wallace Stevens and T.S. Eliot and other American poets, that I would get a job in business. And so I went into the business world specifically to be a writer, and I made myself a promise that I would work on my writing every day. And indeed, I did that for the next 17 years.
How'd you find the time to do it?
With great difficulty. But I would come back, and every night, no matter how tired I was, you know, I would try to read or write for 2 hours. And it was hard to do, but I found that a phenomenon I'd noticed when I used to run track happened also at your desk, which is called the second wind. No matter how tired I was, I'd say, well, let me just recopy by hand the paragraph or the stanza that I'd written the night before. And as I began to do that, new ideas would come up, and by the end of that little copying exercise, I would find myself re-engaged back into the work.
Gee, what a kind of pleasant and easy transition into starting to write for the day or the night.
Well, I think you should always leave yourself a doorway back into your art. I found that it was important even when I became a full-time writer, because until I became the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, the previous 11 years, I supported myself and my family as a writer. And it was always nice to have something that was sort of slightly incomplete, left over from the day before, that wasn't too hard to begin.
I understand that in the 15 years that you worked in the corporate world, you kept your poetry a secret. And the fact that you were published was something that your co-workers, your colleagues, didn't really know. Why did you feel the need to keep that secret?
Well, I didn't think it would do me any good in a very competitive, old-fashioned company to be known as the corporate poet. So, you know, I really felt that I had to succeed in business as a businessman and to succeed in writing as a poet. And so I wanted to keep the lives separate. And it wasn't really until I'd been in the business world a number of years when Esquire magazine decided that they wanted to do a piece on me for part of this special issue they did called the Esquire Register, Men and Women Under 40 Who Are Changing America, that my cover was blown. In fact, I tried to convince Esquire not to run the article, but they said it wasn't my choice. And so at that point, you know, I was outed.
When after you left the corporate world and started writing on a more full-time basis, you said that, you know, in your own way, you missed the camaraderie of office life. How did you feel about becoming an arts administrator when you were asked to become the head of the National Endowment for the Arts?
I accepted the job in fear and trembling. I have to say that I did not seek this job, and in fact, I turned it down, I turned down the possibility of interviewing for it 2 years ago, and said I didn't even want to be considered for it because I'm not a political person. I'm an artist, and I have no political ambitions. And I was, you know, happy supporting myself as a writer. I was very successful at it. And it was really only after they chose a man named Michael Hammond, who died 8 days in office. And during the same time, my own father passed away. I was with him to the very end. I was at his bed when he died. And after September 11th, that when I was approached about the job again, that I agreed to consider it. And as corny as it may sound, after my father's death, after 9/11, you know, I thought that, you know, my father didn't want to go off and fight World War II. I mean, he was not a warrior, but he spent 4 years as a radio operator and a dive bomber, which was a fairly dangerous job, because he felt it was the right thing to do. And so I felt that if indeed my country needed me to come to the National Endowment for the Arts and to try to rebuild this incredibly valuable institution that had been so roughly treated by history, that I had a certain, pardon me for saying this, patriotic obligation to do this. I had never served my country, and I was being asked to, so I should do it. And so I girded up my loins like a man and came to Washington.
Have you taken a stand on the so-called culture wars and on the funding of art with sexual content, transgressive art?
Well, the controversy that surrounded the National Endowment involved a lot of things that were really outside of the endowment. And some of these things actually have been looked at by the Supreme Court, and they came to a decision which I think is the right one, which is that the National Endowment for the Arts makes no decision based on content or point of view. We make our decisions in terms of artistic excellence. That being said, I do think that one of the things that the Arts Endowment needs to do is to think of itself as a national institution that exists to serve the American people, not as a regional institution that serves the arts establishment. And I think that the things that got the Arts Endowment into trouble, this is not an opinion I think held by everyone, were not the controversies, but it was a basic dilemma at the center of the endowment. In its very distinguished history, the endowment had really never been able to serve most of America. There was entire portions of the country that got very little from it, especially rural areas, semi-rural areas, smaller cities, the inner cities, and that we had not done a good job at the endowment of demonstrating our public value. I mean, the most important thing that I'm trying to do at the endowment, is to make sure that we spend the money in an egalitarian and democratic way, that we reach the entire country with programs that people, feel are of value.
You want to give an example?
I think the program that I'm most proud of at the moment is a new venture called Shakespeare in American Communities. This is the largest tour of Shakespeare in American history. We have 6 regional theater companies that we are sending on a tour of over 100 mid-size and smaller cities. These are mostly cities that don't have live full-time professional drama on their own. We're also visiting about 1,000 high schools, and we're bringing really the best new productions of Shakespeare to communities that might not normally get this sort of fare. Now, in addition, we are working with the Department of Defense, who is funding us to bring a 7th company to tour military bases and the communities surrounding the military bases, which are mainly isolated rural communities. I'm enormously enthusiastic about this program because I think it brings art of the highest quality to the broadest possible cross-section of Americans.
Well, it sounds like a great program. But, what you were saying about funding art that reaches the largest audience, raises a larger question about what kind of art should be funded. And one argument would be art that reaches the largest audience. But another argument, and I'd like your opinion on this argument, is that it should just be art that maybe won't reach a large audience. For example, art that might be considered, radical or fringy at this moment, but that is so good and so original that it's going to, if it's funded and allowed to flourish, it can go on and affect the mainstream maybe a few years down the line. Good examples would be, say, the music of Steve Reich and Philip Glass, which were considered very avant-garde and kind of like odd, and were very much like in the avant-garde music and the avant-garde gallery scene when they started performing. And now, I mean, TV commercials use music inspired by them. Or maybe it's actually their music. Who knows? But you see my point, that sometimes the stuff that seems very fringy in its moment and isn't going to reach a large audience in that particular moment will eventually have a profound effect on American culture.
I'm not sure I entirely accept that. That is the theory of the avant-garde. That's a theory of art that was articulated really in the early 20th century in a kind of vanguard of the avant-garde. And to a certain degree it applies, but I think by and large, most art, you know, has some direct appeal. People may not entirely understand why they like it or why they don't. But, you know, I am a real believer in the power of art. And the one thing I refuse to do as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts is to condescend to the American people, to think that they are somehow incapable of appreciating and engaging with the best art of its kind. I mean, I look back to the WPA era in American arts, an enormously visionary program during the Depression, you know, in which the best new artists, you know, got involved in the creation of public works. And I do not believe, in fact, I refuse to believe that artistic excellence and democratic accessibility are mutually exclusive categories.
My guest is poet Dana Gioia, the chair of the National Endowment for the Arts. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet Dana Gioia, the chair of the National Endowment for the Arts. Well, let me ask you another question that I think there's a lot of disagreement about within the arts world, and that is, should most money go toward funding institutions or go toward funding individual artists? And there's, you know, arguments that are very compelling on both sides. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, I'm very practical about this, and I'll give you an example. I mean, I have written two opera libretti with two composers. And I could give, let's say, a $20,000 grant to two composers to write an opera. And they may or may not be able to get these operas produced. And the, you know, the money would probably help them, you know, move the project along. Or I could give $40,000, the sum of these two grants, to an opera company, require matching funds. And we've learned that when we give money to an institution, they can usually leverage it to be about six times the amount. Take that $40,000, turn it into about $250,000, put on a new opera, so there is a composer who actually gets it to produce. He or she gets the benefit of that. You know, the conductor gets the benefit of producing a new opera. The company gets a new experience in terms of their own maturation as a company. The musicians get work. The singers get work. The director, the set designers, the costume designers get work. And the audience gets the experience of seeing and hearing a new work in their own community. Now, we do have individual grants still in a number of categories, to poets, fiction writers, translators, creative nonfiction, traditional artists, and jazz artists. But the other support that we give goes towards institutions, and I think that's probably the most effective and efficient way of, as it were, bringing the artist and the audience together.
Some of the people who led the charge against federal funding for the arts also were very anti-gay, most notably perhaps Newt Gingrich. As you know, there are a lot of gay men and women in the arts world. Is there any hint of pressure on you and the NEA to limit the amount of money that goes either toward gay-themed art or the funding of overtly gay artists?
None whatsoever. The National Endowment for the Arts exists to serve all Americans. Once someone tells me that there's a class of Americans that we're not supposed to serve or not supposed to become partners with, I stop listening. But in all honesty, no one has mentioned anything of this. I think it's a fear that is an unfounded one. And I am, to the tips of my fingers, someone who is an egalitarian. And I believe that a public agency must serve all the public. That's the same way that I want to bring Shakespeare to the military. In the 38 years of the endowment's history, we've never done a large program for the military. There are 1.4 million Americans in uniform. They don't tend to come from overprivileged backgrounds. You add their families together, it's over 3 million people. They tend to live in semi-rural areas where there's not, you know, many cultural resources. We need to do something for them. Otherwise, we're not really serving America.
Are you thinking about the Shakespeare plays
yes.
About the military, like Henry V?
Well, we're bringing Macbeth, actually, on the military tour because...
you're actually doing a military tour.
We are. I mean, I went to the Pentagon, and I had a meeting with the Undersecretary of Defense, and I told him, "Sir, I believe I'm probably the first chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts who's ever come to the Pentagon." And he agreed that I indeed probably was. And I said, "I know I'm the only chairman who has a sister currently on active duty because she was called up out of the reserves." I've got one brother who's a jazz musician, one brother who is a DJ rap music expert, and a sister who's a jock, and she went into the Navy. And he said, "Yeah, I was probably the only chairman that had a sister on active duty." I said, "Well, there's two firsts. I want to make a third first today. I want you to help, get the Department of Defense to fund a military tour of Shakespeare." And I'm happy to say that with the support of Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, that now seems to be becoming a reality. And we're going to be bringing a tour of Shakespeare to the military community, to 16 bases and all the surrounding schools. And I'm really very proud of that. It's a historical first.
Interesting. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Dean Ajoya is the chair of the National Endowment for the Arts. His latest book of poetry is called Interrogations at Noon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our engineers today are Connie Lockwood and Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dutton Books, publisher of La Faire, a comedy of manners and culture clash by Diane Johnson, author of Le Divorce. An excerpt is available at authordianejohnson.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Will Fresh Air be a no-spin zone when Bill O'Reilly joins us? We'll talk with the Fox News host about his TV show, his new book, and his feud with Al Franken. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.